You're listening to Red Nation Online.
You're listening to the North of 49 Soccer Podcast. Interviews, analysis, and discussion about Canadian soccer with hosts Chris Williams and Steve Watcher. All right, here we are back with episode 18 of the North 49 podcast. Chris, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well, Steve. Watching some Olympics and really rooting for Canada as they went through the knockout stage. So, I'm doing really well.
Yeah, that's our first topic for today, which is Canada at the London Olympics. As you mentioned, they're through to the knockout stage and they've qualified for the quarterfinals. At the time that we're recording this, matches are still being played, so we're not quite sure who Canada will play, but they could end up playing against the hosts, Great Britain, or I believe the other options would be Brazil or the United States. So, a couple of imposing opponents, and also obviously the hosts would be a tough match as well, probably playing in front of 100,000 people at Wembley Stadium. So, Chris, what's your assessment so far of the way that Canada's performed? Obviously, we're all watching that in the context, you know, of how Canada played in recent tournaments, played at the last World Cup, and then how they've done since John Herdman took over. They've got one draw, one win, and one defeat, which is good enough for third in the group.
Yeah, I think Canada's come a long way. I know they've made strides and they've had definite success along the way since John Herdman has entered the fold here. Canada has a very prominent attack with Christine St. Clair and Melissa Tancredi, and Tancredi seems to have found her feet, her goal-scoring boots, which is great to see. But you can also see when Canada is playing against the Japanese or the Swedes, and hopefully, versus Brazil, they match their, match the intensity when they play them, because you can see there's a technical deficiency among Canadian players, and that's on men's and the women's side. We've always struggled with that technical part of the game, and as I said, Canada has done very well to have success along their road and their journey, and they should be very proud of it. But I just hope that, moving into this knockout stage, that they regain some players from injuries, and it's a hard one, Steve, when I look at it, because I want Canada to win, but it's just they're going to come up against a stronger opponent like a Brazil. And as you mentioned there, against Great Britain, I think Canada can actually match them technically and, physically, but that home crowd, that support will be tough to overcome. But I think that, if they play the Great Britain, I believe that they can overcome that and get through and move on to the next round of games. So, not too sure what John Herdman has. I know he's up against it with some injuries, some key injuries in the back line, and hopefully he can show up at defense.
Yeah, Emily Zurer and Robin Gale are, I believe, out for the tournament now, and Candice Chapman, who's kind of the back line general there for Canada, is also out, but I think there's a possibility that she could come back at some point, depending on how far Canada goes. One of the most positive things, in watching the three games thus far, has been the play of Melissa Tancredi. As expected, if anyone that watched those games saw Japan and Sweden in particular, really marked Christine St. Clair very closely. So, a lot of analysts were calling for her teammates to sort of pick up their games and have a breakthrough. And, Melissa scored plenty of goals in her Canadian career, but she seems to have brought it up a level in this tournament. What's your assessment of her play, and how important is it that maybe she's hitting a hot streak, right when Canada needs her the most?
Yeah, I think it's been hard. I mean, you had Kara Lang, you had Christine St. Clair. I think Credi has always been a part of the women's national team. But it's hard when you're not playing, and at some point, the penny drops and players find their rhythm, and it seems like Tancredi has been given this opportunity and she's running with it. And she's making the most of her chances. I think back to maybe it was the first goal against South Africa. It was a great first touch or redirection. But she seems to have found her feet and her rhythm, as I mentioned earlier, and it's working for the Canadians. So really look to Melissa Tancredi to continue this. And who knows, she can go on to be Canada's player that leads them to Olympic success.
A lot of the talk around Canada heading into this tournament centered on the fact that that under John Herdman, the team was doing putting a lot of emphasis on the mental aspects of the game and trying to build up the confidence and the mental strength of the team. You know, looking at the results coming in third and, you know, not being able to get a win over Japan and Sweden might be disappointing for some. But as I watched both of those games, you know, I was impressed with the way Canada bounced back. You know, in both games, they, I mean, Japan scored one great goal, and then the second goal, I think, was, you know, preventable by Canada. And against Sweden, you know, those backline injuries, I think, had Canada looking a little bit disorganized on the back line, and I don't think those were great goals to give up either. But in both cases, Canada came back and made a game of it. Against Japan, it still ended up being a loss, but after being two down, you know, we've seen matches in the past where it's sort of been two goals down and you're finished. So the fact that Canada came back and got a draw today to just really put their destiny in their own hands and guarantee a spot in the quarterfinals, I think was very impressive. So, you know, looking at their mental state and heading into those next matches, they haven't had the breakthrough of beating a team ranked ahead of them, but they have played quite well against a couple of very quality opponents. What are your thoughts, Chris?
Yes, taking away the sloppiness at the back, Canada has to shore up that defense and become organized again, because if you take away those goals, Canada's in the game and potentially could be, you know, up a goal or having a lead going into a half, or, you know, potentially winning the match. So once Canada figures that out at the back, then I think they're in business. Steve, there. I mean, it's just a hard one, because I want Canada to do well, and they have done well. Nobody should, you know, any Canadian should look at that team and feel proud. The mental aspect is a major component of the game. And John Herdman has definitely implemented, you know, strategically, you know, a method of having these players overcome, you know, defeat, and even during the match, you know, being down a goal or down two goals. So he's worked on that with the players, and you can see it, right? And that's a mentality and a culture that we as Canadians have to have, especially because we're behind the eight ball, technically, I feel, always. So that has to be a mental, you know, a part of our culture, to never give up and to never really give in to any type of circumstance when you're facing, or when your backs are against the wall. So hopefully the mental aspect and the mental strategy for John Herdman and the Canadian women's team works for them.
Okay. Well, it's going to be interesting to see how they do and, you know, who their next opponent is. I think at this stage there always tends to be an upset of some sort, so, you know, just getting there, you know, gives you a ticket to the lottery. So we'll see how Canada does in their upcoming matches. And certainly, you know, all of Canada is behind the Canadians women's national team and hoping that they can come through and achieve their goal of winning a medal at the London Olympics. Now, moving on to the MLS, I want to start off by chatting a little bit about the Montreal Impact. And I'm going to be purely selfish in that sense, just because Saturday's match between the Impact and the New York Red Bulls was one of the most enjoyable and fun ones that I've seen in in weeks. I really enjoy watching Montreal play. I live in Toronto and follow that team closely and keep my eye on Vancouver. Vancouver's higher in the standings than both Montreal and Toronto. But just in terms of pure entertainment value and appreciating the style of play, I have to admit I've enjoyed watching Montreal the most this year. They bounced back really nicely on Saturday against the Red Bulls after suffering, you know, a poor defeat to Houston the week before. Chris, how do you think Montreal, you know, did in bouncing back? And what does that say about the character of the team, as well as the ability of Jesse Marsh to adjust his tactics after, you know, being soundly defeated by the Dynamo?
Yeah, Jesse Marsh definitely has a stranglehold on that team. That's his personality when he played. Fiery character, and I want to talk about never give up, never give in against a strong New York side with Thierry Henry, and they do so. And you can see through Thierry Henry's praise of Montreal and his awareness of the club there and what they've done is great to see. And even speaking about one of our Canadians and Patrice Bernier. So Jesse Marsh definitely has impacted this team, excuse the pun there. But they have certain pieces in place. And even with the signings of DiVaio and Nesta, they have, it seems they have the model in place to be successful, and they have a great leader in Jesse Marsh. And hopefully Joey Saputo and Nick DeSantis give Jesse the time that he needs to build that team. It's not going to be a year. I know both Jesse Marsh, or sorry, all three of them, Jesse Marsh, Nick DeSantis, and Joey Saputo, they come from a winning mentality, and sometimes there's impatience there. But once Jesse Marsh has the patience from Joey Saputo and Nick DeSantis, then I think Montreal will be in business in the years to come because they have the pieces in place.
Yeah, I think people forget, even with all of his MLS experience as a player and with the experience he gained as an assistant coach with the U.S. national team, that this is also Jesse Marsh's first go-around as a head coach in the MLS. And I think, you know, he's learning from week to week as well. I think he maybe had a bit of a tactical misfire against Houston. Obviously, you need to rotate players from time to time due to a heavy schedule. But, you know, sitting out Patrice Bernier and Justin Mapp in the Houston match and then playing Felipe quite deep as more of a deep-lying holding midfielder, I think that was pretty much the genesis of that defeat to Houston. They lost a lot, most of the battles in the midfield there. He made a switch up against the New York Red Bulls, you know, inserting both Bernier and Justin Mapp, who I think links up quite well with DeVille, back into the starting 11, and he moved Felipe forward to the point where he was playing just behind DeVille up top, and I think that really plays to Felipe's strength. So, you know, it's good to see that those adjustments being made, and you know, just watching the team, you can see it growing every week, and you can get a real understanding of you know, where players' strengths are and how the pieces are fitting together. Obviously, that match was also notable for Marco DeVille's first goal, but even more so, Alessandro Nesta's first MLS match, and you know, very nicely, it ended up being a win for Montreal. I thought he looked assured and composed, and you know, he brings a presence back there. There's a lot of talk in Toronto this week about the presence that Eric Hasley brings, you know, up top for any team that he plays for, and I think Nesta brings a similar presence to the back line just based on his experience. And you know, he was already there barking out orders and you know, making sure that everyone was in the proper position and whatnot. You know, what are your thoughts on Nesta? And you know, he's up there in age, but I don't think he can beat that experience that he brings to the team.
Yeah, it's similar to looking at Torsten Frings at Toronto FC. You know, World Cup experience. You know, played over, I'm assuming, 300 professional games at the highest level. Champions League winner Nesta is, and a World Cup winner, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't think you can buy that experience in terms of just that knack for just seeing a play happen before it even transpires is something that's going to be a great asset to the Montreal Impact. So I think it's a great acquisition. Montreal will definitely benefit from his leadership and from his ability on the ball, you know, spraying balls from the back. Remember, months ago we spoke about Montreal's inability to actually play balls from behind and really start their attack. So with Nesta's experience and his ability on the ball, they'll be able to do that. And I'm sure Jesse Marsh is grateful for that because that was a weakness in their game plan and strategy moving forward. So Alessandro Nesta is a great move and you know, signing for the club, and we haven't spoken about the fan base, but I'm sure they appreciate having, you know, a player of that pedigree at the club.
Okay, well, you know, in a very timely fashion, our guest today is an expert on the Montreal Impact. You know him quite well, and he's a veteran of both the Montreal Impact and the Montreal soccer scene. So why don't you go ahead and introduce our interview guest this week, Chris?
This week's guest is none other than Lloyd Barker. He was a striker and defender for the Montreal Impact for many years. He's a Jamaican international, former Jamaican international, and now a broadcaster with TSN. We welcome Lloyd Barker to the Northern 49 podcast.
Lloyd, you were a part of the Montreal Impact for many years, and now, after stepping away from the organization and viewing things from a personal and professional standpoint, what is your opinion of the club in terms of its growth from your playing days to now, with it moving to the MLS in 2012?
Yeah, you're right. I've been with the club since the first day, actually since the first camp in early 1993, in March, on a crappy turf field in Claude Robillard, Montreal. And, you know, from that point on, we really just thought it's just nice to have professional soccer. For me, there was a transition over from the old CSL, the Canadian Soccer League, and the Montreal Super had made the jump over and changed names under new ownership with the Saputos at the time to become the Impact. And so I was fortunate to be around since then, and all the way through up until I retired in 05, and I became the assistant coach at that point, and then held that role for a year before becoming director of youth development for the next few years with the team. So, you know, it's been a long journey, and from the outside looking in, or rather from the inside, initially, it's really been kind of special to see the growth and where it's gone, and you know, because it's really been a gradual growth. There were no steps really skipped. There were a lot of details that were just proper throughout the process on through, and it wasn't without its issues, mind you. I mean, the team went bankrupt, I remember, in 2001. Even before that, in 1999, the Saputos gave up the team for a year. They took the year off, and they never came back to the team until 01, when the league asked them to return kind of to help us out after we'd gone bankrupt that year. But then since 2002, there's been just a real rebirth of the club, rebranded, if you will, and the emblem changed, and really that's when the club really took to another level, from, you know, the 2,000 fans we averaged in 93 to, you know, the 6,000 fans, you know, in 1998. And then, boom, 2002, all of a sudden, it's double figures every week, and really had to expand the stands. It's just, for me, it's been a proud, proud process to watch. And to be a part of, and I'm a little bit more distant than I was initially, obviously, all those years, because I'm now calling the shots and calling the shots from a standpoint of my opinions, being in the media booth and in the broadcast booth. So now I get to throw some shots back at some of my friends, so it's all fun.
Lloyd, you mentioned those shots that you're throwing, but I mean, there's no mistaking the Italian presence at the club now. You know, with owner Joey Saputo and Nick DeSantis, who's the sporting director, being of Italian descent. And, of course, there's influence through Alessandro Nesta and Marco Di Vaio. How do you feel that the club has strong Italian roots and a connection with those Italian players and, as I mentioned, the Italian descent with DeSantis and Saputo?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could, you know, a lot of fans have asked that. That's a good question. But, you know, I guess you can understand the route they've taken with the Italians coming here. I mean, I'm Jamaican, and I would naturally, if I owned the team, the first probably import I would think to bring in is the best Jamaican player available. And it's probably a natural instinct of the people involved and that are in the position to call those kind of shots. In addition to that, you can't question the caliber of players they brought in. Marco Di Vaio, I mean, the top footballer for many, many years and continues to be. He still has something in the tank, although his age is against him, being 36 right now. He celebrated a birthday while here, actually. Nesta, the same thing. But both these guys were playing top-level football as recent as last season with their clubs in Italy. So you can't question who they brought in. The case of Ferrari, Matteo Ferrari, he's a little bit younger, so yes, he has more to give to the team. Another Italian vet who's played for the national team. Bernardo Corradi, the same thing. He's a little bit old. He's closer to the Vaio's age of 36. And Nelson Rivas, who has Italian influence. He's played for Inter Milan under Jose Mourinho. So you can't question that they've certainly brought in quality players. I mean, if you want to nitpick, and that's my role now, to nitpick and look at details. But, you know, both pros and cons. You know, one has to wonder, where does this end? I mean, there are more nationalities out there where good footballers come from. I mean, Portugal, and where there's a strong ethnic influence in Montreal, and that's also important to, the supporters. You know, there's a big Portuguese influence here, community, big African, there's a big French community naturally. Arabic is taking over. I mean, there are no probably household Arabic names, but, you know, that's also another option. So you ask yourself, and obviously it's nothing against the Italians that are here, but you can't help but wonder at what point do they start looking elsewhere to find other players. I mean, a very good French player can be here, and he would be just as influential in drawing numbers to the seats as a Di Vaio, as a Nesta.
Given that Martin Rennie and the Vancouver Whitecaps chose to go with different players up top, were you at all surprised that the Impact did not make an attempt to acquire Eric Hastley?
Not at all, actually. I wasn't really surprised. I would have been more surprised they didn't try to get him in preseason, when at that time the team was clearly without an out-and-out striker, or certainly any notable strikers. At that time, DeVaio was just an afterthought, or a hope anyway. There were other names that were on their sheet of hope, including Del Piero, including Drogba, Nicolas Anelka. So there were other names that were out there, but I think at this point now, after they drafted Andrew Wenger, they brought in DeVaio. Karate's out injured, actually, so that's a little bit unfortunate for them. They do have Eddie Sabrango still in the roster. At that time, they did still have Justin Braun. It was in and around that time that deal was made also. Justin Braun actually left Montreal. Whether or not he's worthy is a whole other story, but the fact that they had those players here, doesn't surprise me that they didn't go for Hasse. And I think probably the last discouraging straw would have been his salary. He is a designated player. I'm sure that could be rearranged, that he comes to Montreal without being one, but I'm sure he wouldn't want that. So that probably would be a tie-up in the negotiation. But I think at the end of the day, they play with only one striker here. That's their preferred formation, one out-and-out forward striker, target man, and DeVaio is that. So at the moment, even Andrew Wenger, who has shown, Andrew Wenger is this first overall super draft pick from last season, he's shown that when he plays, he's got enough quality in him to certainly get the goods done if given the opportunity. But they only prefer the one. You know, they went against Lyon last Tuesday with the two up front, and it's kind of because it was an exhibition game, they really didn't think too much about it. So just to give the guys some minutes. But they do just go with the one, and so I think all those things combined, doesn't surprise me they didn't go for Hastley. Now, I would have liked to have seen Hastley here at the beginning of the season.
Lloyd, I'm sure there's much talk about Patrice Bernier's performance in the last few weeks and the last month anyways. His omission from the Canadian national team and most recently in the World Cup qualifiers, surprising to some, maybe surprising to yourself. At the time, Patrice was playing below standard, and I believe he had to go through a transition period. You know, as players move back from Europe, they always go through that brief stint of just adjusting to things in North America. What are your thoughts on Patrice's omission, and how do you think his current stand-up performance have affected Stephen Hart's CONCACAF World Cup roster?
Well, you've asked a few things there. I don't think he's actually playing poorly in the beginning, to be very honest with you. I think he is, and the handling of him, Patrice Bernier, that is Jesse Marsh's number one mistake on the season. I think he was held out for about six games, and I do not think that he was playing poorly. As a matter of fact, the game, just ironically, the game where he was the benching began was for me his best game up until that point. That was the game in New York where they lost 5-2, and for me he was the only player, and it was puzzling to most, certainly to me, and certainly to the man himself, as you can only imagine. But you know what? Credit to Bernier. He stuck it out. He persevered. Never a negative word. Never a hint of dismay. He really just took it, continued his work. I watched the number of training sessions during that time, and you would never tell that this is not a guy that feels he should be playing, but that is not getting the minutes. What he's doing now, for me, by the way, he is, for me, Montreal's most important player at the moment. And he's only showing this now a little bit more clear because the role has changed a little bit. Initially, Jesse Marsh had him playing a lot more defensive and defensive only. When he started getting success with the group was when he started pinching forward and choosing his moments going forward. That's when he chipped in with a couple goals. He's actually lead the team right now with six goals. That's when he was closer to the target man and the wingers. He was distributing balls in the final third a lot more, so he was not getting on the end of us. He was being a provider and racking up assists. He leads the team with five. Sorry, he's second in the team now with five. Felipe has since passed him. But it's when that role changed, when he was given the opportunity to pinch in whenever he sees fit, because Bernie has that intelligence. He has the capabilities to choose the right moments to go, when to hold, and so on. And so that, for me, is why he's become the most important player, because tactically, he's as sound as they come. So I don't think he had a poor season. I don't think he was playing poorly at any point. I think his role was different, and that was as a result of a tactical instruction by the head coach. So for me, I blame the head coach for that. And then, you know, again, like I said, for me, Jesse Marsh sitting him out for 6 games was the most puzzling thing, because I knew Bernie had more to give. Exactly what he's doing now is exactly what he had to give then, except he wasn't asked to do that, and now he's being asked to do that. And, you know, I think the national team head coach has to have seen this, because if you ask anyone within this club and they're honest, they'll tell them that, yes, there's Nesta now and DeVio. Of course, they have high quality. Felipe has been tremendous. But I think as an overall player, back to front, you're talking about Patrice Bernier, for me, as the man, the glue to this team, really.
Lloyd, I can't say I disagree with you at all about Bernier. He's been fantastic. And I do agree with your assessment of Felipe. I think maybe he's been the impact player who I didn't know as much about heading into this season, who's really impressed me. How did he land in Montreal, and did the Impact organization know just how good he was going to be prior to the kickoff of the MLS season?
they hit the jackpot with Felipe. He's, first and foremost, he's just 21 years old. He's got a bright future. There's no question about it. He's still learning. He started in Italy, in Padova, and he's come from the Swiss League, and that's where they found him. They do. Montreal does have a connection with the Swiss, a connection in the Swiss League, and so that's how they found him. And I think just for this team, but certainly for the league, he has such a high volume. He works 90 minutes. He's one of the few guys that, given that role in an attacking midfield role, he works for 90 minutes, and he does exactly what he's supposed to do as an attacking midfielder. He stretches the defense, he stretches them wide, and he drops in the hold and causes a lot of problems. And as I mentioned about Bernier being one of Jesse Marsh's biggest mistakes, it just so happens that in recent games, not the latest games, but just prior to this, Jesse Marsh changed even Felipe's role in a sequence of games where they kind of dipped in play, and that kind of coincided with DeVio's dip in play as well, because Jesse Marsh had asked Felipe to drop back in a holding midfield role along with Bernie, and actually took off Colin Warner, and so that really affected Felipe greatly, and he was really, for lack of a better word, ineffective for the team, certainly from what he was before. And so now finally they're back to him just staying up front as high as possible, connects to DeVio. And for me, I think he's the only player that that understands the real movements of DeVio and what he wants and when he wants the ball. And so I think that's the value he serves to this team, because he for me, is the number one guy that understands the movement of DeVio the best. So, you know, I'd say Bernier is the top guy. But if he's not, then certainly at a close second is Felipe, for sure.
You've been quite critical of Jesse Marsh, and rightly so. Lloyd, there have been questions from afar with respect to how long Jesse Marsh might last within the Impact organization. What is your assessment of Jesse Marsh? And judging from some great performances this year, has his staff done enough to prepare the players for this expansion year?
Well, you know, Jesse Marsh, poor Jesse. Look, he was always going to be against it here in Montreal. This is the place, and I know when he came here, I think he signed a 2-year deal, and maybe a 3, but it doesn't even matter. If it was a 10-year deal and he feels reassured, I'd be the first to tell him when he signed that deal, don't feel reassurance in that, because this is a place where winning is everything. And I know the owners, I know the sporting director, Nick DeSantis, as much as they understand there's a process that's involved with an expansion team, these guys want to win, and they want to win now. So, you know, when they brought in an expansion coach, it was always going to be a big challenge. And Jesse, I'm sure he would have known that coming in. Now, has he done enough? You know what? He's made some mistakes, but for me, he's made rookie mistakes. And it's mistakes, if you hire a rookie coach, you would expect a rookie coach to make. And I think that's what I see going on. Now, I do sense an air of contradiction within the club and within Jesse being in the club, because I know the owners want to win. I know the sporting director wants to win, but yet they hired a rookie coach. And I also know that, you know, there's going to be a situation where you've got a rookie coach who's never been a head coach anywhere. And so has he done enough from my standpoint? I think he has, because he's doing what a rookie coach does. I've seen him make plenty of mistakes along the way, but he's learning on the job, and because that's what new guys do. They learn on the job, and it's an expansion team. The players are learning on the job. Everything is new to everybody, including the guys that have been in the league many years, but it's about getting that team cohesion, and that takes plenty time. And so for me, he is that guy that you would expect him to be if you really understood the process of what's going to happen with an expansion coach taking over, a rookie coach taking over an expansion team. Case in point, for example, he went 3 in the back against Toronto when the Impact were a goal down, and within 10 minutes they conceded 2 goals, Montreal, and the game was over. And just a couple of games later, he did the same thing again. I believe it was Kansas City this time. They were down, and within 2 minutes they conceded that's with 3 in the back. Well, I happen to know that that's not something that they've worked on a regular basis in practice. And so that's a rookie mistake. That's a rookie coach mistake. And that's enough to get a veteran coach fired. But is it enough to get a rookie coach fired? Probably as well, but it would be unfair. I don't think Jesse Marsh will last. If he lasts this year, I don't think he will last into next season. And it's just because I just know that this city... you know, with the owners, with the sporting director, Nick DeSantis, the owner, Joey Saputo, with the city, with the expectations of the club, it's about winning now, and it's about winning now, and it's about winning now. There's no tomorrow. It's now.
In that vein, Montreal has not stood still in terms of their roster this season, and they've made many changes and many smart acquisitions right from the MLS expansion draft through to the current transfer window. What do you think are the main areas of the team that the Impact should still be looking at improving?
Well, I think the number one problem for me right now are the fullbacks. The team has shown since day one, which has kind of been a big surprise to most people and certainly to me here, is the fact that they have no problem scoring. And since the opening kickoff of the first game, they've done well. Yeah, they went through a little spell where they weren't winning games and scoring goals, but it wasn't for a long spell. And, you know, they've got, I believe there are only 5 or 6 teams in the entire league that have more goals than them at this point. They've got 33 goals. And so they have no problem scoring. Now, the big problem was that they were conceding so many goals, of course. They lead the league with near 45 goals conceded, and so that has been their negative. Now, I think they solved that problem with Nesta coming in. Rivas was always an option, but he's been in and out through injury. Ferrari, he just picked up an injury as well, and so now these guys are all healthy. So I think now with Rivas, Ferrari, and Nesta all healthy, all fit, they've got a solid back line. However, what I see wrong with this team since day one is that they do not have overlapping fullbacks. And it's beyond me why. And then you add in the wingers, because the wingers don't even get a lot of crosses in. So they become really one-dimensional in attack. And so that's kind of been something that I've kept a note of. But for me, if they're going to add anything, I would think to go out and add a fullback that gets up and down the sidelines and they get crosses in the box. A guy like this guy I used to know named Chris Williams, he kind of does stuff like that.
Thanks for the mention, Lloyd. You know, speaking of former teammates, Eddie Sabrango. Ever since I've known Eddie, he's been a consummate professional, really top-class individual. And Lloyd, you know Eddie, the signing, some people would say that it was just a promo a promo signing. The club wanted to honor Eddie and to give the fans a little bit of respect in terms of that. But I want to know your thoughts, your candid thoughts on that signing. And also, you know, what do you think his role is with the club, you know, especially with his age? There's no hiding that.
Yeah, you know, I love Eddie Sabrango. This city loves Eddie Sabrango. I think 99% of the supporters love Eddie Sabrango. Initially, he earned his way onto this team, so I don't think anybody could doubt that. So I don't think it was a publicity stunt, because Eddie's not going to draw anyone to the stands, to be quite frank. But people will appreciate what he does, and that's why everybody loves him. They know he's an older guy, but they know he wears his heart on his sleeve, this guy. And when he's on that field, whether 1 minute, whether 90 minutes, he's full out for every second of that minute. And you mentioned consummate professional. Well, you know Eddie's not going to get himself in any trouble off the field. You know, at practice, he's prepared more than anybody else. And that's what he brings. So I don't think it was a publicity stunt in any way. He earned himself on that roster. And if you remember in the beginning of the season, again, that was the number one issue with the team, where the goals were, number one question, rather, where the goals were going to come from. Because they didn't really have any proven strikers. They drafted Andrew Wenger, but obviously he's coming out of college. He wasn't even a full-time player in camp at the time, still finishing up his degree at Duke. They hadn't had Bernardo Corradi as yet. He came late in camp on trial, and he wasn't even proven until they ended up signing just before the season started. And then, of course, like I said, with the others, with DeVaio and the other DPs that they had in mind, they were just really hopes. And so Eddie Sabrango was really the only guy. I mean, Justin Braun, and I mean, he's another story, because I don't Justin Braun, the time he was here, he didn't show me anything to warrant even playing over Eddie at any point in the season. And that, again, for me, was another Jesse Marsh mistake, because Justin Braun was, for me, questionable to even be an MLS caliber player, let alone starting over Eddie Sabrango, who is proven to me and proved in preseason that he's more dangerous in front of goal and offers a lot more to the team than a guy like Justin Braun, who, by the way, has since been gone. So clearly Jesse Marsh acknowledged that was a mistake and has gotten rid of him. I just think now Eddie has just fallen in the pecking order, because it's a situation where they only play with one striker. And so it's always challenging for any player when you join a club. If you're a striker, the first thing you ask the manager is, how many strikers do you use? You know, what's your formation? Because if it's only one and you look at the roster, you will know that you might never play, or you're going to play a limit of minutes, because it's one that's still there. He gets his minutes. You know, he got about 10 minutes the other day. He played half the game in Lyon, and people just loved him and cheered him on. And, he looks so light-footed out there. He's so bustling. You could just see the eagerness in him to try to score. But God bless him, because he works his tail off for a young 39 years old.
Lloyd, Montreal's been doing very well at home, but struggling on the road. You know, that's not individual to Montreal by any stretch, but I'm wondering, are you seeing any gradual improvement in their performances on the road, and do you expect to see them pick up more points in the second half of the season playing away from Saputo?
Well, I actually think that's where they're going to fall short of the playoffs, because if it was all about, if they played the rest of the games at home, I think they'd make the playoffs. But I think the fact that they're going to play games on the road, that's where they're going to fall short. And this is where the whole thing about what MLS is to Europeans comes into play, because Major League Soccer, the challenge is not just on the field, it's off the field. And we're talking about traveling, we're talking about time zones and so on, and we're talking about games in you know, 4 or 5 days. We're talking about 5 games in 15 days. And so this is where that challenge comes in. Now, I'm confident when you're at home, you're a little bit tired, you can find the adrenaline to pull you through. But when they're not your fans, there's 20,000 people in the stadium, and they're not your fans, and you played your third game now in 9 nights or something like that, all of a sudden you can't find that adrenaline. And I think that's what's been wrong with the team. It's no different than any other team, really. But more so an expansion team, who I think the attitude, it's all about attitude when you go on the road. And they simply just have not developed the right attitude on the road just yet. We saw that with Vancouver last year. They had a great attitude at home. The intensity was there. The energy was there. But then, you look at the stands and you see the energy from the stands, and you wonder, you know, where it came from. It's obvious. It's from the stands they're getting their energy.
And they go on the road, and there's, you know, there's five fans, so it's not quite the same. So they you know, that attitude I speak of, that's what I mean. It's the intensity. You know, the concentration level is not there once you go on the road. So they're conceding penalties. Montreal are late penalties. You know, silly fouls. They're causing fouls on top of the box late in games, conceding set pieces. And that's how they lost games on the road, but that's what expansion teams do, and that's what teams that don't understand how to win games do as well. That's what they do, basically. And I think it's, you know, that's as simple as that. It's just a bad attitude they have when they're on the road, a negative attitude, and it's, you know, they're against it because they're an expansion team.
Lloyd, there's been much discussion about Canadian development. You know, with the MLS, Major League Soccer, Canadian teams, now we have three. You know, are they struggling to develop Canadian players? Recently, Carl Ouimet has many people buzzing about his development and potential. Is this hype, or is this the makings of a real Canadian superstar? And is any example for future players?
You know, I'm happy for the young man. You know, he's... Before 20 years old, he's cracked the MLS roster. It's very impressive. And take nothing away from it. And take nothing away from the process that's got him to this point. The question now is, and by the way, I've seen him play. I've seen where, you know, the players are, they look capable, whether it's, you know, NASL, whether A-League, whatever. But for some reason, the first, you know, sign of shall we say, lack of progression in this player, that the head coach will have assessed him to be at, he's gone. You know, you look around and his locker room's cleared out, or the season's over and he doesn't return, and these boys kind of go to the dogs, as they say, because you don't see them after 2 years. They've quit the game at 25 years old. I'm curious to see where this will play out, because he is a central defender. He could play fullback, but he's a central defender. And I'm curious to see where this will go and how far he will go with this team. That will tell me what the intentions of this signing are in about a year's time. If he's still on the roster and he's still just rubbing the pines and he's not getting in games and exhibition games or the final 20 minutes, or a clear, obvious sign to me that they're trying to get him minutes to develop and to be a starter, then I will question the signing today. Now, again, in saying that, don't take anything away from the young man. He's earned a spot. They've signed him on. You know, I always say, you've been given the opportunity, and it's up to you to steal the spotlight and seal it. So they've opened the door for you, whether it's for, you know, to please the Quebecois fans, to the Italian fans, whether it's to make the academy seem useful, whatever the reason is, you're now legitimately on the roster. Now, can you steal a moment and earn yourself a spot of certainly a multi-year deal kind of thing? But it's a good thing. I just think, you know, overall, that when you look around Canada, Toronto for me is Canada's team, because they've got so many academy players that are making the first team that are also playing on the national team. So I label Toronto FC as Canada's team. Vancouver, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find a Canadian on that team. They got rid of Dunfield. He was one. They got rid of him. He's in Toronto. And who else is out there? I mean, they're trying to label Alain Giroux-Chad as Canadian, which, shame on them, because he doesn't know anything about Canada. He's from Switzerland, or French, rather, or Switzerland, one of the two. And so for me, Toronto FC is Canada's team, unfortunately. And you'd like to see Canada's team win a few more games.
Lloyd, on that topic, who are some of the other promising Impact Academy players that you think could make the jump to the pro team in the near future?
Well, I don't have a name for you, to be very honest with you. I really don't, but because I don't know what they're looking for. And, you know, there are some players from last year's team that for sure I thought would have cracked the lineup for this year, certainly as young players. Maybe it's, you know, the 27th to the 30th player, and those guys were gone. So clearly what I thought was not what they thought. So no sense giving you a name now and you know, nothing comes of it, because the fact of the matter is, it's about philosophies. And I believe if you have an academy, you have to have in your academy a player or two that comes out of there. If it's not every year, it's every 2 years. And because you have to show me a purpose. What's the reason of having an academy just to play exhibition games? Does it make any sense for me? So I want to see players that are in the academy that are getting
legitimate chance to graduate to the first team and seasons. But he was not really one of the ones you would expect to have made the roster now. But we'll see where this all goes, because, you know, there's always a debate about the MLS drafts, the academies, the college drafts, and the likes. And they're trying to figure now what's more useful than the other. And at the moment, I don't think there's any set conclusion after seeing that where these players are coming from.
Lloyd, just to add there, you mentioned Alan Rochat being Canadian. You know, there's been rumors and speculation that he may be jumping ship to Montreal in the near future. You speak about, or you've spoken about, overlapping fullbacks, so maybe that's something to look out for in the coming months or towards the end of the season. You never know.
Well, see, that would make sense, because he's a natural left-sided player, and there are not many of those here. They had Tyson Wall, they got rid of him, and now they have Jeb Borowski, who's an up-and-coming. I mean, Jeb Borowski, I believe, was in Vancouver.
Yes, he was.
And he's here. He's not a natural left footer per se, and they also got Zarek Valentin. But both are young players, and you know, they've got futures in the game. But you don't need two of them. And at the moment, with Ferrari coming in, I think they're probably forced to put him on the left side of defense. That's probably what's going to happen, because, like I said, you have Zarek Valentin, you have Jeb Borowski, Tyson Wall when he was here, Kamara now, Hassoun Kamara, who slipped out to the right fullback position now. He played that last game against New York. These guys, they're really just going to half line and stopping. So they really only need, you know, fitness up to half line, really. And it's limited football. It's not modern football. And, you know, they might slip in Ferrari out there, because really the fact is he's a better defender than a Zarek Valentin, who's injured, by the way. He's not considered for us to be picked anyway. But certainly Ferrari's a better defender than Jeb Borowski. And so if Jeb's going to go to half line, well, I might as well put Ferrari in there. He's a better defender. So I think that's probably what's going to happen. So with Rochat coming in, potentially, that would make a lot more sense, because they need someone like him. And not just from a left-sided player, but his characteristics of a player who gets up and down and crosses the ball in the box. I like him, by the way.
Well said. Switching gears a bit, there's been a reduction of ticket prices during the season. What's that all about? And, you know, did the ticketing office, do you feel they got the numbers wrong?
They acknowledged that, didn't they? So, you know, it takes a man, it takes a real big man to stand up when he's made big mistakes, and especially when it's in front of public.
Yeah.
Joey Saputo's acknowledged that they misjudged the market and what was required, and they reduced the prices. You know, I laugh because the same day they announced that the Nesta signing is the same day they announced the ticket drop price. And wouldn't you know it, it was the biggest crowd in the next game, and then it translated to this recent game last Saturday against New York, where they had the sellout, quote-unquote sellout, because the stadium is still not completed and there's some seats still being worked on. But it was sold out to the max allowed. That's really what happened. They just really, they thought people, because, you know, the big hype in Canada at that stadium, in Montreal anyway, at that stadium, 60,000, and that was with David Beckham. So I think people thought, well, that you could continue to do that at the Putin Stadium. But unfortunately, that's not reality. David Beckham is a special case. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows his value to this league. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, just to tell you, Thierry Henry was supposed to come the next game. It was New York that was coming. And it was just last second that he pulled out with injury. And it was still 20-odd to 30,000 people. So it was half the crowd of David Beckham. Just, and Thierry Henry is a big name. And they had at that time Kenny Cooper, who was the leading goal scorer in the league at the time. So, you know, it's a unique market. First, you got to be winning, and you know, you can't give the people something that's affordable for so many years, then all of a sudden, you know, because you're in another market now, you can't all of a sudden jump to put it to a whole nother level where people are looking like, whoa, what just happened? Isn't this the same product? Well, it's a little bit better from previous, but is it that much more? And I think that's what they quickly found out. But like I said, it takes a man to accept his mistakes, and Joey Saputo stood up and didn't hide behind anybody. It wasn't a press release. He stood up in front of the cameras and said, we made a mistake, and we're reducing him now. So you can afford the tickets now, Williams.
Lloyd, in many ways, Montreal's first year in the league was always going to be judged up against how Toronto and Vancouver fared in their first seasons in the MLS. What is your overall assessment of the job that Joey Saputo and the Impact organization have done in relaunching the club for Major League Soccer?
Well, first of all, you can't do any worse than Toronto. And second of all, they are ahead of Toronto because they've got 8 wins already in their first season. That's 10 games to go. You could see more signs, more positive on this club and the way the club's being run than how Toronto was being run in their first year. And I say positive signs because that's all. We're just looking at potential, really. Excuse me, that might have been my head there. Vancouver, for me, last year, what they did, I thought they actually played well in many games. They struggled on the road, not picking up a win after the entire season, which is you know, a feat in itself. But certainly they've got it right now. They brought in a new coach to get it right, and you can't complain about what he's doing. He's kept his team in contention the entire season. So they've clearly got it right. I think Montreal, they just hit, you know, they've hit some unfortunate situations with injury. I think they've made some mistakes in the draft as well. And I think they've kind of done things a little bit too late. You know, the DeVaio signing was a little bit too late. The Nesta signing was a little bit too late. But, you know, I think that's the positive sign. You look at Toronto. Toronto's done things well periodically over the course of their 6 seasons. But it wasn't a consistent process where they've, you know, everything for that year was proper, or most of the things for that year was proper. It's just a piece here and a piece more. So it's always 2 steps up and then 1 step back. And that's how it's been with Toronto. I think Montreal's ahead because I see with 10 games to go, this team could probably win another 5 games out of the 10, maybe another 3, and build from that. And I think at the end of the day, when you look at this team going into next year, you will say to yourself, they don't need a lot of pieces, just a few pieces. After Toronto's first year, well, they needed to blow up the ship, and that's what they kept doing each year. And, you know, it's been a disaster. Vancouver, kudos to them. I mean, they've clearly got it right. Even last year, I don't think it was wrong. I think it was just typical expansion when they just needed a few tinkerings, and I think they've done that. So, for me, I think Montreal is ahead of the game. I think, you know, the games that they've lost, you know, their record now compared to what Toronto was or even Vancouver was in their first year is certainly at best even par, and it's in part because the other two clubs as well were similar on the road. They were very terrible on the road, shall we say, and I think that's where the problem lies.
Lloyd, a final question for you just to finish off, and following on Steve's question, would you say that Joey Saputo and Nick DeSantis will be satisfied by the end of the year, and are they satisfied right now?
No, I don't think they will be. If they say otherwise, I think they'd be lying. I do not think Joey Saputo is satisfied. I don't think Nick is satisfied. I think the fact that the stadium was not sold out for a number of games will have been very disappointing to them. The ones at the Olympic Stadium with the massive attendance, yeah, those are great. But they weren't all sold out as well. I think that would be disappointing to them. I think, you know, separate from that, the fact that the stadium was never sold out is a massive disappointment. I know Joey would have liked, you know, perfect scenario. The seats are full. The boutique is being bought out, and the team looks good on the field. I think there's been a number of, you know, player management issues with the head coach, with a few players that has kind of spilled into the locker room, so that, you know, they won't be happy with that. And so, and at the same time, they're in a position where they're not clearly in a playoff spot. You can't say. You know, they're like in a Vancouver situation. Vancouver clearly looks like they're on the right path. It's only lately you can say that with Montreal. There was a period there where they'd gone games and looked really bad. You know, even though they competed well in most of the games, but their segments that they went, they looked really bad and looked like they were going downhill, actually. Backwards is probably a better way to use a better word. So, you know, I know those guys, they love to win, man. Joey storms out of stadiums when the team loses because he loves to win. And he has that passion of winning, and it's the tradition that this club is kind of built on.
And we're back. And, Chris, certainly some interesting thoughts from Lloyd Barker there, and definitely exciting times with the Montreal Impact. But, you know, moving back to the other team, Canadian teams in the MLS, exciting times there as well with, you know, Vancouver still in a solid playoff position and Toronto recently excelling with a new head coach. So let's talk a little bit about Toronto FC. Their undefeated streak and winning streak came to an end on Saturday with a tough loss to Houston. Some mistakes on the back line leading to the Houston goals. And Houston's one of those teams where I don't know if people underrate them or whatnot, but they make you pay for anything that you give them, and that's exactly what happened. I don't think there was a huge gulf between the two teams on Saturday, but certainly Houston is a more experienced, cohesive, and complete team than Toronto is right now. You know, what did you make of the result from Toronto's standpoint? Was it just one of those games, or did a light bulb go off and this is something that Toronto should be concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a bit of both, but not to be so cliche, but there's some chinks in the armor there. And, you know, the back line, that inexperience that we always speak about, Steve, you know, Eckersley, Emery, I mean, whoever Toronto or Paul Mariner, you know, implements there in those positions in the back, they're going to struggle. They're going to have games. They're going to go through some growing pains, and that comes with being a young player and an inexperienced player. So I don't think they should be alarmed. They have some big games coming up, and those players should be resilient at this stage in their career. But one thing to mention, Steve, Houston is a cohesive unit, as you mentioned. And Brad Davis really, I felt, took control of that game, especially on set pieces. You can see his delivery. Terry Dunfield, I felt, played a pretty good match. He had a strong match. But I think in that match, Houston outplayed Toronto in the midfield despite Terry Dunfield's play. And I just feel there's a disconnect between the back line and midfield. And if they shore that up, because they need to work their way up to Eric Hasley, who's just signed with Toronto, then I think Toronto will be an even more competitive team. They need to acquire maybe a defender, as we all have been anticipating. Hasn't happened yet. But, Houston, that you saw their experience versus inexperience. And hopefully Paul Mariner and his side will regroup for Wednesday's Champions League match.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're a different defender is rumored to be coming to Toronto every couple of days. And, you know, so far they haven't been able to come to an agreement with anyone or, you know, go that final step and get an experienced defender signed up to sort of bring some more experience to the back line. Certainly the players that are there now all bring some quality to the team and have excellent pace and athleticism, and you know, they're young, so they just need someone to guide them back there. I thought it was a very interesting match watching that back line, in the sense that probably the best player on the day was Richard Eckersley, who was, you know, a right back who for several weeks now has been playing out of position at center back. And you know, he's only 24 or 25 years old, and he's sort of the veteran leading a bunch of young players on that back line. And you know, he made a number of excellent clearing plays and challenges that, when you looked at them, just in terms of his pace and the physical nature that he brings to the game, they were very impressive. But you know, when you look at them in a larger context, you know, I was watching the way Houston played, and they never even had to make those types of clearances. It's just you know, Boswell and Hainau were just in perfect position every time, that there was never any need for sort of a perfectly timed challenge or anything like that. They always shut down the danger before it even happened. So, you know, well done to Richard Eckersley in that match, but I think it was also a clear indication that, you know, that TFC still needs to do some work on getting that backline together. I do have to say that, you know, I'm high on all of those players. I think Eckersley is, you know, from his character and the energy that he brings to the game, he's fantastic. I'd still like to see him back at right back. I'd like to see Donnell Henry, you know, not playing as a right back, even though he's quick down that right side. I'd like to see him back at center back and playing that way. I think Logan Emery has shown enough to show that he's a squad player in the MLS. And, you know, Ashton Morgan is, you know, a fantastic young player and a key part of the TFC defense. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the team does, if they can still bring in someone. They did make an announcement today, but it wasn't a defender. They've actually signed Freddie Hall, who's a keeper that had been on trial with Toronto for the last couple of weeks. And his signing is an interesting one. You know, it's rumored that it's a multi-year deal. Of course, those are probably all options for the MLS in the way that contracts are structured in Major League Soccer. But it looks like there's four keepers now signed for next season, with Milos Kosic, obviously, you know, the incumbent, playing in England. So it looks like, you know, we're a long way off from the off season, but something's going to have to give over the off season in terms of, you know, getting that number of keepers down to a more manageable number once Stephen Fry's back fit and playing. It brings up an interesting question. You know, Toronto hasn't won so many games this year and have struggled, but I thought Milos Kosic has always been one of the best players in pretty much every game. You know, heading into this season, it was kind of a two-headed monster with him and Stephen Fry. But, you know, just looking at the season as a whole, is this Milos Kosic's team now, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it seems that way. He's probably been Toronto FC's most consistent player. You know, there's something to look at there, Steve, with the goalkeeper situation. You have Quillen Roberts, who's a young player, young Canadian international. He's played for the youth teams. And if I'm looking at it, I from that playing perspective, I would be a little bit nervous. You can also take it on the other side and say, you know what, it's motivation for Quillen Roberts to, you know, continue working hard and staying focused. But four keepers is definitely, you know, when they say, Steve, three's a crowd, four is definitely a crowd. So I'm not too sure what they're going to do. At some point, Stephen Fry, I believe, will be moved on from the club. His contract, I'm not too sure of his contract situation, but it'll be moved out. Or they'll have to sell Milos Kosic. Again, I'm not too sure. I look at that goalkeeper situation. It's great to have, you know, goalkeepers that are competent and can actually be first-team keepers. But at some point, those players are going to want to play. The Hall signing, I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure where he fits in. Truthfully and honestly, Roberts maybe might be a little bit too young for Paul Mariner in terms of, you know, playing experience. So he wanted a keeper with more experience to shore up and just be the backup for Kosic. So it's an interesting situation, Steve. I don't know what Paul Mariner's thinking, to be honest, but definitely, I don't think anybody can criticize Paul Mariner for changing things at TFC. He's done things his way and moved out players that he didn't want there and now has acquired players that he's wanted. So there's a method to his madness, and I guess we'll have to wait and see regarding the goalkeepers.
Yeah, Paul Mariner, upon signing Freddie Hall, has mentioned that he would like to see Quillen Roberts possibly go out on loan to an NASL or USL team. So that's a story to watch there. You know, as we watch Milos Kosic, you know, play fantastic every week in, week out for Toronto FC, we shouldn't forget that he had that year where he was the third keeper and was playing in the CSL with the Serbian White Eagles. So, you know, a little bit of succession planning and, you know, building organizational depth. I think it's smart on Toronto FC's part. You know, I think there's still one keeper too many there when everybody's healthy. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out, and it looks like it's not going to be an issue until the off season. Now, moving on to Vancouver. Vancouver lost to Real Salt Lake playing in Utah on Saturday, and that loss dropped them to fourth place. Now, taking into account that not many teams go into Rio Tinto Stadium and come out with a win.
So there's been some changes at the club, and they just have to regroup. It's basically a new team. They have new DPs within that roster. So, Martin Rennie is doing things his way, another coach that has changed the landscape and the dynamic of a Canadian MLS side. And it seems to be working. I mean, they've had some pretty good results along the way. They are fourth, however. You know, Salt Lake, they've gone to Salt Lake I think Cannons received the red card in that match. But it's just, I mean, didn't go the way they wanted. But they'll regroup from it. I believe they have a week off or a few days off of training. So it's a good opportunity for them to, you know, to get acclimatized, those players. Even Robson, he's looked stronger and stronger as he's joined the Caps. So I don't think Martin Rennie is too concerned. Again, for him, it's almost an expansion year for that club again, just because it's a complete overhaul of players and, you know, technical staff. So I think the Whitecaps are excited, as they were, you know, at the beginning of the season. Martin Rennie actually has the players, just about all the players that he wants in, you know, when he signed with the Whitecaps. So I think he's very optimistic looking forward.
Okay. Get one final comment for you on Vancouver before we finish off for this week. As you mentioned, Vancouver now has a week off. They won't be playing on Saturday while Toronto and Montreal will be competing. You know, given the amount of change that the team roster has gone through and the fact that I think they were on the road for pretty much most of July, you know, how big is it that how big a boost is it that they're going to have that week off? And I would expect a whole week of time on the training pitch to work together on integrating these new players on the team, as well as maybe working on fixing some of the issues that might have cropped up in some of the less desirable results they've achieved, you know, over the month of July. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for them to readjust and become accustomed to one another. Something that a dynamic that we don't really discuss is away from the field. You know, there's some great bonding activities, Steve, that we don't need to mention it on Red Nation on our podcast. But even traveling with the team, players are gonna get used to each other. Just their tendencies away from the field, and of course on the training pitch. So it's a real opportunity for Martin Rennie to bring in the character type traits and personalities that he wanted to. And make a mistake, Steve. He's implemented some strong, experienced players, and it will definitely change the dynamic of that team. And, I don't think there will be too many chinks in that locker room, in that armor, with the Whitecaps. I think he's shoring up his defense with Jay DeMeritt. I have to mention, Jay DeMeritt played quite well in the All-Star game. I'm not too sure if everybody was able to watch that here in Canada, but Jay DeMeritt had a good, solid performance in that All-Star game, and they still have a strong defensive presence with Alan Rochat, Lee at the back with Jay DeMeritt. So I think Martin Rennie has implemented attacking pieces that will carry Vancouver into the playoffs. I'm just not sure how deep, but even despite their change in dynamic, they'll do quite well.
All right, well, that's it for this week on the North of 49 podcast. Thanks very much, Chris, and thanks to everybody for listening. And a special thanks to Lloyd.